This is hell.
Okie doke. Manufacturing dissent since 1996. This is hell. The authoritarian-like language and actions of the Trump administration might seem brand new to you. Coming out of nowhere, a political anomaly that is the direct result of reality TV, celebrity culture, and social media. But it's not. American authoritarianism has been on the rise for a long time, long before Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. Returning to This Is Hell on a special, albeit abbreviated, one-hour edition of This Is Hell, it's our correspondent on all things authoritarian, neoliberal, and, well, fascist, Henry Giroux. This week, Henry will talk to us about his new book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, as we will look deep into authoritarianism as it already exists in the States, its impact on our everyday lives, on our culture and society, as well as on our political imagination, and how authoritarianism can be challenged in the age of Trump. All right now and alive, completely uninterrupted by anything. This is hell. Henry is currently the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. Find out more about Henry at henryagiroux.com. That's G-I-R-O-U-X. We also might have a live report from our man in San Juan, Puerto Rico, Dave Buchan. Of course, with electricity and communication still very shaky in Puerto Rico, who knows? After all, this is live radio and not that prepackaged, pre-produced crap you get on NPR. I'm your bitter, blind, broke, gap-tooth radio show host, Chuck Mertz. Producing this week's This Is Hell is Alex Jerry. Alex, what's new by you?
Are you excited for that new flat screen in the entryway when you can't get into the building because your car doesn't work, but you can look at pictures of students' photos of themselves?
I am very excited about that. I'm also excited about the really janky, horrible Halloween decorations upstairs. What the hell? How old are those things?
Oh, I haven't seen that, but there's a tub of Laffy Taffy in here.
Oh, really?
Do you want a Laffy Taffy?
No, yeah, during the show, I think that'd be great. This Is Hell is broadcast live without interruption on WNUR 89.3 FM, Evanston, Chicago Sound Experiment. Streaming live online on our website, thisishell.com. Podcast shortly after at the same place, thisishell.com. Now airing an abbreviated one-hour version on Sunday mornings in Moscow, Idaho, on KRFP and on Lumpen Radio in Chicago's South Side. If you want to hear This Is Hell over the air on your local radio station, assuming you still have one, and impose our content upon your neighbors, email us your local radio station's call letters to Chuck at thisishell.com. Again, if you want to hear us on your favorite local station, email us the call letters to Chuck at thisishell.com. It might just be my headphones. Again, let's say, or better yet, email your local radio station and tell them why This Is Hell is God's favorite radio show. And if you don't believe me that this is God's favorite radio show, all you have to do is prove me wrong. Brave enough to be live, dumb enough to be goofy, stupid enough to think that we can be a regular part of your weekly hangover, This Is Hell. And Alex has this week's hangover cure.
This week's hangover cure is porridge and lots of water. A really great, really interesting one this time. There was an article posted this week at Cosmopolitan, which are words that you are certain you never thought you'd hear here on This Is Hell. The article was headlined, Eight Nutritionists Reveal Their Hangover Cures. In it, they quote Rhiannon Lambert, a registered nutritionist and founder of a leading clinic in Marylebone, central London, called Retrition. Lambert says, I'm never a big drinker, so it doesn't take a lot for me to feel the impact of alcohol. With hydration being a cornerstone of health living, I always remind myself to drink far more water on the day after drinking than I normally would, so it could easily be over 2 liters. On the menu would be a refreshing smoothie bowl or a filling porridge with nut butter and berries. That makes this week's hangover cure, that drunk Goldilocks favorite, porridge chased down by lots of water, which is weird because we never thought her favorite hangover cure was bear meat.
Bear meat? That's disgusting, Alex. This is not the media. This is hell. The caste system isn't just for Hindus in India anymore. Nope. United States revealed this week that the U.S. has a caste system too. And I'm pretty close to the bottom. Of course, I'm not at the bottom because I'm a white dude. But surprisingly, there are non-whites and non-dudes above me in the American caste system. Surprisingly, because until last weekend, I thought my white dudeness, my white privilege, which I cash in on an everyday basis, superseded everything. But apparently not. Unlike India's caste system, the U.S. caste system was not created by the Hindu god of creation, Brahma, nor was it exacerbated by the British Raj, that is, the British monarchy's rule of India from 1858 to 1947, which segregated India by caste and would only give the best jobs within the colonial government to members of the highest caste. And is it any surprise that the horrible, awful British Empire would use a racist system to divide and conquer its subjects? That's one thing about the British Empire. It never disappoints at being really disappointing. No, the American caste system wasn't imposed on us by racist outsiders. Instead, our caste system in the USA, 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 has been imposed upon us by professional sports leagues. And last Sunday, we saw how it was forced upon us by the National Football League and their fans. As we have learned since the hashtag Take the Knee campaign started by former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick to bring to light the level of racism people of color face at the hands of police, there is a caste system in the U.S. And just like the Indian caste system, we have our own Brahmin. But they're not priests, teachers, and protectors of sacred learning. They're also not those fancy high-end Brahmin designer leather bags that start at about $250 retail. Although some of our Brahmin do look like leather bags, but that's just mean. Our Brahmin, instead of being educators or theologians, are active military members and veterans. They are first and foremost the people who the flag and national anthem represents before all others. You know, the flag that looks a bit too much like the East India Trading Company flag, the British company that was formed to do business in Southeast Asia, but instead seized control of the Indian subcontinent and then exacerbated the caste system during their nearly 100-year rule of the region. The U.S. flag and the national anthem are first and foremost for veterans and current soldiers, pilots, sailors, and merchant seamen, the best kind of seamen. So any of you who have not or are not serving in the military, sorry, that flag and anthem is not as much for you as our first-class citizens who join the armed forces. The rights and liberties that song and flag represent are for them, not us, and by us I mean everyone out there who never served. Of course, there are many of us who can't serve, so that ripped-off British drinking song from an upper-crust London men's club that is the Star-Spangled Banner, it ain't ours as much as it is theirs. Not that our forefathers and mothers were apparently all that crazy about the song, as it was written in 1814 but didn't become the national anthem until 117 years later in 1931. And it wasn't easy getting the national anthem to be the national anthem either, because it took 15 years and 40 attempts by Congress to actually name it the national anthem. And it's no wonder that the song took so long to become our national anthem. After all, it was written by admittedly tone-deaf Francis Scott Key during the War of 1812, a war that hippie peacenik Francis Scott Key opposed completely. In fact, considering the militarization of our culture and society, I wouldn't be surprised if Key would hashtag take the knee. Or maybe he would simply leave the football stadium in disgust or sheer horror when fighter jets fly over at the cost of millions of dollars in taxpayer expense. But don't worry, folks. Trump's tax cut plan won't have any impact on those costly, wasteful flyovers or any aspect of our military budget, which is prioritized over fighting poverty, the health and education of our children, caring for the elderly, and, well, everything else. It gets worse, because in the fourth verse of the Star-Spangled Banner is this lovely stanza. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. It gets worser. As John Schwartz wrote in The Intercept in August of last year, the reality is that there were human beings fighting for freedom with incredible bravery during the War of 1812. However, the Star-Spangled Banner glorifies America's triumph over them, and then turns that reality completely upside down, transforming their killers into the courageous freedom fighters. After the U.S. and the British signed a peace treaty at the end of 1814, the year the anthem was written, the U.S. government demanded the return of American property, i.e. slaves, which by that point numbered about 6,000 people. The British refused, most of the 6,000 eventually settled in Canada, with some going to Trinidad, where their descendants are still known as Americans. So what do you know? oppressed black slaves in pre-Civil War U.S. do have something in common with the fans that insist we stand for the national anthem and refuse to recognize the unequal policing of the United States. They both call themselves Americans. But I don't measure up to those current and former members of the military, no matter what they did before, during, or after their careers in the armed services. Doesn't matter if they committed a crime and were forced to join the military by a judge, or if they committed a war crime, or if after leaving the military they did anything heinous. Nope. The flag and anthem are theirs and not mine. I'm of a lower class, a near bottom untouchable class of Americans who that flag and song do not represent as much as those who were drafted or volunteered, because if I volunteered, the military wouldn't take me. And I had a real rough patch in my long, rough patch of a life, and I'm pretty sure I would have joined the military if it wasn't for one thing. I'm designated 4F, which means I'm disabled and unfit for duty. That's right, my optic nerve myalgia causing me to be legally blind makes it so I'm just not, never will be, and never could have been as American as all those GIs. I never had a chance. My disability is one I have had since birth, so my real American citizenship could never live up to any veteran. From Benedict Arnold to William Calley to Lindy England and Charles Grainer. So when the flag flies and the anthem is sung, it's not as much about me or all Americans as much as it's about those who served in the military. First and foremost, our warrior class, dear Sparta, although in Sparta, if you took a knee, it was in fealty, showing loyalty to your lord and master, which makes me wonder if Colin Kaepernick, like that douche Jon Snow, would have bent the knee to Daenerys Targaryen, because I'm betting no, as she seems to have a lot of slaves, and I'm certain Kaepernick does not kneel to any master. So from here, at the murky depths of the American caste system where the military is our overlord, who we shall not ever question, who we shall always support, who fight in wars that we should always fight no matter how much we've been lied to, whether it was with the explosion of the USS Maine or the non-attack at the Gulf of Tonkin or the lies that led too many Americans to believe there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Down here near the bottom of the ladder, where those who are born unfit for military service must always live a life with less of a claim to what it means to be American, and who always sits during the national anthem at Cubs games because standing isn't mandatory yet. This is Hell. Coming up on this week's This Is Hell, American Authoritarianism in the Trump Era, maybe possibly a live report from San Juan, Puerto Rico. We might have listener feedback. We will definitely get to what's happening on upcoming episodes of This Is Hell. We're not going to do Twist Off Knowledge of Libation of the Week this week again. You are listening to God's favorite radio show. Prove me wrong. This is Hell. American authoritarianism didn't start with Donald Trump ascending to the presidency, and it wasn't caused by reality TV and our celebrity culture. It was caused by a culture of forgetting, refusing to take responsibility by an economic system that's cruel and brutal, uncaring and selfish. Here to help us understand what authoritarianism means in the era of Trump and how we can fight it if it's not too late, Henry A. Giroux is author of the new book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome back to This Is Hell, Henry.
Hi, Chuck. How are you? Good to be on the show.
Always good to hear your voice, sir. You can find out more about Henry at henryagiroux.com. To what degree do you think the U.S. public is committed to democracy? After all, there was voter suppression that many think led to Trump's election and an unfair advantage for Republicans. And you had voters in New York City complain during the Democratic primary that they did not have the typical access to voting they had experienced in the past. So to what degree is either party truly committed to democracy?
Well, I don't think either party is basically very committed to democracy. I think that democracy, since we heard right from the beginning with the Trilateral Commission, if not the people who framed the Constitution, I mean, democracy gets in the way. It's messy. It seems to suggest that people should have power over their lives and should have power over some power over the commanding institutions that shape their everyday existence. And I think that's completely anathema to a ruling class elite on both sides of the political spectrum. I mean, I think that the only difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Republicans are so extremist and so crazy and so ruthless and cruel that they just don't code. They don't use code anymore to hide their anti-democratic tendencies or their disdain for people in general except for the ultra-rich, whereas the Democrats will basically throw out some elements of the social contract to suggest that they're really on the side of justice, but a form of justice that in the end really doesn't serve the people in general at all. I mean, the other side of this is that when you ask the question to what degree do people believe in democracy anymore, remember, you know, since the 1980s, you know, we've heard a discourse that really seems to suggest that matters of community, matters of solidarity, matters of justice, matters of freedom are basically irrelevant, that the real issues that matter are issues of self-interest, deregulation, privatization. We've really killed the language of democracy under this form of casino capitalism, market fundamentalism, neoliberalism, whatever way you want to name it, that's exacerbated every other form of oppression that we can talk about, whether we're talking about racism, we're talking about sexism, we're talking about gay rights. I mean, basically, we lost the language of community. We lost the language of democracy. It was disparaged, just as we've lost the language of solidarity. I mean, when you hear the president of the United States chastising the mayor of the mayor in Puerto Rico because the woman is saying, "Look, people are dying here," and not only does he chastise her, personally insult her, but also says, "Well, you know, you can't expect too much from government." Bingo, there it is. I mean, the government is not responsible for people's lives. You're responsible for your own life, and if you're in trouble, too bad. And I think that when given all of that, coupled with, and I somewhat disagree with something you said earlier. I do think celebrity culture. I do think, you know, politics follows culture. You know, as Vaclav Havel used to say. And what that means is we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it about? What's going on in the culture that makes people illiterate? You know, what's going on in the culture that allows people to elect a pathological liar? What's going on in the culture in which fear becomes more important than shared responsibility? And I think you begin to put, you know, what's going on in the culture in which schools are utterly degraded, defunded, and are turned into workstations for Google? You know, I mean, when you begin to look at all of this, you begin to understand that people don't have the language, they can't make the connections, and it's very difficult for them to understand how to position themselves in the face of a whole range of oppressions that bear down on them. The other side of this is, yeah, there's a minority of people who believe in democracy. Young people, I think, in many cases, believe in democracy. I think that, you know, there are people around who operating around single issue movements that believe in democracy, but I think that's a minority. I think for the most part, the language of democracy is under enormous attack. And I think that there's a very dark pessimism that haunts the United States around liberal democracy now.
Well, there's two things I wanted to touch on there. We'll get to the culture aspect of it in a second. But you write that not only is the public in peril and it is on the brink of collapse as the economic, political, and cultural institutions necessary for democracy to survive are being aggressively undermined. As these institutions vanish from public schools to healthcare centers, there is also a serious erosion of the discourses of community, justice, equality, public values, and the common good. So to what degree are these institutions under attack because the public doesn't realize how much these institutions are necessary for democracy? Because it always seems to me that people will say they believe democracy but are opposed to the institutions necessary for democracy. So what explains that disconnect? Why aren't these institutions valued more by the public?
No, it's a terrific question. I mean, I think, you know, there's a terrific tension in the United States between democratic values and commercial values. And I think that people have bought the Kool-Aid. And the Kool-Aid seems to suggest that commercial values are far more important than democratic values. And hence, there's a misunderstanding of both these institutions and how valuable they are to democracy itself, and the presupposition that because they have some relationship to government around questions of care, around questions of the social contract, that somehow they promote a very bad form of dependency and a really poisonous, in general, to civil society. And I think that, you know, that's where the extremists have won. You know, they've taken a notion of freedom and they've defined it as the freedom to pollute, you know, the freedom to defund public institutions, the freedom to attack unions, the freedom to do away with the commons. And since people believe this stuff, they can't translate what it means to talk about private troubles and how they're linked to systemic issues. And how, in some ways, you know, we need institutions that are able to basically address those systemic institutions and not simply argue that most of the problems that people face are simply individual problems. I mean, this unbridled extreme individualism that haunts and shapes the country is at the very least one of the foundations for authoritarianism, because what it does is it not only mobilizes itself around fear, demonization, and hatred, but it drives people into forms of symbolic communities that in many ways have nothing to do with the problems that they're facing. There's also another side to this, and I just one second, because I want to do justice to the terrific question. The other side of this is that, remember, ideas matter, but they don't matter enough if you don't have the institutions to propagate them. If you don't have schools, if you don't have places, if you don't have public goods, you don't have public spheres, if you don't have places where dialogue can take place and people can come together and question and read and understand and analyze, those ideas begin to evaporate. And when you live in a country like the United States, where basically most of the cultural institutions, most of the pedagogical institutions, from schools to the media, are dominated by a corporate elite, these are not basically public spheres in the best sense anymore. These are often toxic spheres that basically align themselves with market-driven values that promote enormous amounts of mass suffering and basically cultivate an ideology in which people basically don't know how to deal with democracy and what its demands and responsibilities might look like.
You mentioned individualism, and there's this inconsistency in hyper-individualism that I don't understand. I hope that you can explain it to me. There's this idea that it's your fault. It's not the system's fault. Everything is your fault, and that's very embraced by the right. At the same time, the right says, no, it's not my fault. It's their fault. It's the Mexicans' fault for taking my job. It's the Muslims' fault. It's black people's fault. How is this individualism? Can you explain this inconsistency in individualism?
Well, yeah, let's be realistic. When they talk about individualism, they're really talking about individualism for white people. Right. It's part of a logic that appeals to what they consider to be their base, you know, meaning that they want to convince the American people that, you know, government is a terrible thing. And hence they've latched on to a relationship, a trafficking between individualism and freedom that seems to suggest that the only way that freedom can basically be attained is to presuppose that everybody is responsible for all of the issues that they face. So therefore, it's freedom from interference, freedom from government, freedom from those racial hordes that basically threaten our jobs, you know, freedom from black people who basically exist in a criminal culture, freedom from Syrians who are all terrorists, freedom from Muslims who in some fundamental way, you know, are going to blow up the United States any day now. I mean, so I think that you have to understand this notion of individualism with a notion of freedom that's a freedom from, and at the same time, ultimately rest on the false assumption that there are no systemic problems, that basically those problems are individual problems. They ultimately can only be solved by people who bear some sense of responsibility for the situations that they find themselves in. And, you know, that's it. Everybody else is basically your enemy, except people who allegedly have made it, because clearly they've assumed a notion of individual responsibility that's laudable.
Earlier, when I was saying that authoritarianism didn't start with reality TV and celebrity culture, I was paraphrasing it a bit, but I was in reference to what you write. And you write how Donald Trump's election is the endpoint of an assault on public goods, community, and civic literacy that has been going on since the 1970s. Americans have lived through an ideological assault by the corporate and financial elite, who have successfully inundated society with a hatred of community, an unchecked celebration of greed, self-interest, and a deep disdain for public morality. Ayn Rand's glorification of the self, hatred of altruism, and notion that compassion is a morality for the immoral supports not only a failed sociality and failed state, but also a social order that gives birth to monsters. So how much is President Donald Trump the inevitable outcome of the Republican Party project that began with the rise of Ronald Reagan in the late 70s? Did Reaganism set the stage for Trumpism?
There's no question. Are you kidding? I mean, that's the beginning of a counter-revolution. That's a counter-revolution on every public good that would be essential to a democratic society. I mean, remember, one of the things that Reagan was immediately appalled by when he became governor was the fact that the University of that students were basically protesting at the University of California. And he said right off that, know, there was no way the government should support institutions that basically allow this kind of critique to take place. And I think in many ways, that burst of democracies in the 60s was like a tsunami for the right. I mean, they never really got over it. And I think that what we've seen since the 1980s is a systemic evolution of in a whole range of areas, from policy to the production of anti-public intellectuals, to the production of all kinds of institutions and resources that are aimed at doing everything that is possible to isolate people, to atomize people, to lead them to believe that criticism is basically anti-American, and to promote a sense of conformity. And at the same time, the collapse of the social state, coupled with the rise of a punishing state and police state, that has almost done democracy in. I mean, you know, the language of Trump is the language of fear. It's the language of Lee Atwood. It's the language of racism. It's the language of demonization. It's the language of fascism. And I think that in many ways, people weren't surprised by Trump because we've been hearing this. We've been hearing this for a long time. The difference between Trump and these right-wing extremists, both in the, particularly in the Republican Party, is that Trump is just honest about it. You know, I mean, you know, as Jeffrey Sinclair said recently in Counterpunch, he just pulled the shroud away. He says, no apologies. Sorry, I'm a racist. No apologies. You know, Mexicans are a rapist. Sorry, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure the rich get richer. And if there are disasters like in Puerto Rico, I believe in the politics of disposability. Take care of yourself, you know, no problem. And if you criticize me, I'll just say you're stupid and un-American. I mean, we see this now sort of working out, right? In a whole range of spheres, everything from sports and football and basketball to Puerto Rico. I mean, what we're looking at, and this is one of, in my estimation, one of the most dreadful elements of the new authoritarianism, is a politics of disposability. Meaning that more and more groups are considered disposable. The excess, you know, they get in the way of rich people getting even richer. And they serve a purpose. I mean, they become the basis for Trump being able to mobilize and speak in the language of fear and demonization that makes people all the more part of a community, because that's the only language left. That and the language of militarization, war, and violence are the only language left that basically is capable of unifying, it seems to me, many people in the United States. And he becomes the endpoint. He's the endpoint. He's the Frankenstein monster. All the parts were put together in the last 50 years, and all of a sudden all the parts were there, but they were finally put together with Trump.
Why are celebrity culture, reality TV, even social media, why are they so much more seemingly conducive to authoritarianism and not to understanding, peace, love, and understanding? Why are they so conducive to fascism or neo-fascism and not doing right, the good thing?
They're part of a series of logics that go something like this. First of all, they're part of a manufactured illiteracy that make people stupid. There's no question. I mean, this stuff is idiotic. You know, it lowers the bar to such a degree that anti-intellectualism becomes more important than being informed and reasoned and evidence and making deliberative, sensible arguments. So they basically represent an attack on reason. Secondly, they're part of something that has a long history in authoritarian societies. They're part of the spectacle. This is the spectacle of violence. This is the spectacle of entertainment, parading as entertainment, but basically is teaching people that in some fundamental way, all that matters is the culture of immediacy. All that matters is, you know, screaming on game shows or mimicking the worst dimension of neoliberal ideology. There's only one person left on the island, right? Survival of the fittest. They also tie in many ways with the notion that the only way that democracy really works is based on the model of the game show, call in and give a vote. I think when you add all of these up, you understand a couple of things. One, that they confer an enormous amount of authority when it comes to both defining oneself, relationship to the other in the larger world. Secondly, it seems to me they're one of the most powerful pedagogical forms that we now see in the culture. There's been a fusion of power, culture, and everyday life, unlike anything we've ever seen, given the new technologies. These things distract, they distort, they isolate, and they don't educate in the best sense. This is not about educating citizens to be informative, to be critical, to be intelligent, to have a sense of historical or public memory, or an appreciation for public goods. This is all about self-interest. This is all about the spectacle. This is all about the culture of immediacy. It's all about commodification and buying. I mean, you add all these things up, and you really get a culture that promotes things that we should be ashamed of, and yet celebrates them in a very powerful way.
We are speaking with Henry Giroux. He is author of the new book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Henry is our correspondent on all things authoritarian, and you can find out more about him at henryagiroux.com. You point out how prior to Trump being elected, from the right to the left, there were people calling Trump a fascist or neo-fascist, from liberal outlets like Slate to right-wing sources like National Review, from people on the left like former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich and the actor George Clooney, to conservatives such as Andrew Sullivan and Robert Kagan. They were, quote, arguing that Trump represented a loud echo, if not a strong register, of a fascist past updated to correlate with the age of reality TV and fatuous celebrity culture you were just talking about. But you add that such arguments too often ignored and continue to ignore the latent authoritarianism and anti-democratic forces that have a long legacy in American politics and society. What do you see as those latent authoritarian and anti-democratic forces that people like Clooney and Reich and Sullivan and Kagan all miss?
Well, I think that many of these people are liberals who basically have used Trump, have described Trump as a kind of eccentric clown that now embodies the echoes of an authoritarian past. And I think that what many of them absolutely refuse to recognize is that, as we had said earlier, that many of the elements of fascism that basically took on a new form in American society were already present there. I mean, the long legacy of racism, the rise of the mass incarceration state, the attack on the environment, but most of all, the massive inequality that existed in the United States. You know, these are not forces that are conducive to democracy. The attack on public goods, you know, the notion that education is about testing rather than about educating young people to be critical, the lack of investment in young people, you know, the war on youth that we've seen over the last 30 years, the rise of the police state, you know, the shifting of military weapons from battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan to, you know, the Podunk Mississippi police forces. I mean, this is not just about Trump. I mean, it seems to me to not recognize that is to fail to recognize something absolutely crucial, and that is capitalism and democracy are not the same thing. These are people who all believe in capitalism. They cannot imagine that inherent in this evolution of capitalism to its present toxic and poisonous state, there is something so fundamentally authoritarian, so fundamentally wrong with any viable conception of democracy, that they have to end up blaming people like Trump. I mean, what I find interesting, Chuck, and I'm sure you know this, is, you know, in light of Trump, you actually now have Democrats saying that that Bernie Sanders is a curse upon, you know, the American politics, that we really need to move more to the center. You know, we need to stop talking about poor people and immigrants. You know, we need to talk about economic issues. And I think that is so indicative of the failure of these people to really come to grips with what's wrong with the United States. It's anti-democratic tendencies, it's attack on public goods, you know, it's a terrible healthcare system that basically benefits the rich, you know, the enslavement of young people financially, particularly those who are going to college and are now burdened with debts as high as $50,000 to $100,000 a year. You know, these are systemic issues. These didn't appear with Trump. Trump has just consolidated this stuff, made it worse, and is totally unapologetic about it because basically he's an authoritarian with no clothes on.
You write that language has also been transformed to produce and legitimate a culture of forgetting that relishes in a flight from responsibility. Capitalism, racism, consumerism, and patriarchy feed off each other and are mobilized largely through a notion of common sense, which wraps itself in a vocabulary of certainty and eschews any notion of self-reflection and shows little sign of losing its power as a pedagogical force. How much is common sense a way in which we disconnect ourselves from any responsibility we may have in being complicit in a culture that continues to allow racism, sexism, poverty, and inequality?
I mean, common sense, particularly at this moment in the United States, has reached a point where it may be the ultimate signifier suggesting the degree of mass illiteracy that the United States has now embraced. Common sense is another way of saying you don't have to think about what's going on. That, you know, we don't have to be reflective about what Trump says. We don't have to be, we don't have to make authority accountable. You know, we just, it's either a matter of divine right or we just give up our sense of agency and go along with what's happening. I mean, every night I watch CBS and NBC just to get a sense from Canada here of what's going on in the mainstream media. And, you know, these endless interviews they do with Trump supporters who, and sometimes they'll say, well, he says this, but he's doing that. And they say, I don't believe it. That's fake news. Or they'll say, so what? You know, he's still doing a good job. There's absolutely such a flight, not only from any sense of self-reflection, any sense of the past and how what Trump is doing echoes the worst dimensions of what we might call, you know, authoritarian regimes, or the contradiction between what he says and what he does. None of this stuff, it seems to me, is on the table to be questioned. None of it employs a notion of reasoning that says that power should always be interrogated. That you should never accept at face value what people say. That basically, you know, you have to learn that at the basis of agency is the ability to engage your critical faculties. And that means using reason over emotion. I mean, and I think that what we now find is we find ourselves in a culture so awash in a sort of poisonous anti-intellectualism, a refusal to think, that you end up with somebody who can say anything. I mean, really anything, and is held almost entirely unaccountable by millions and millions of people who basically believe that reason, thinking, and critical analysis are something that only elites do.
How much does the uproar over athletes kneeling during the national anthem at sporting events, how much does the condemnation of dissent reveal any slide the U.S. may be taking toward not only authoritarianism, but a more militarized society? And how much do we...
I'm with you. I mean, I heard your little, you know, your commentary before I went on. And I think there's a lot in there that speaks exactly to the issue that we're talking about. We're not talking about patriotism here. You know, this argument that Trump is making, we're talking about something fundamental to authoritarianism. And that is dissent is a disease. That there's no room for dissent in authoritarian institutions. I'm sorry, in an authoritarian society. So he's not really speaking just to black athletes, these athletes are mainly black, right? He's really speaking to educators. He's really speaking to people in the healthcare field. He's really speaking to people in the intelligence services. He's speaking to a whole range of people because what he's saying is, hey, look, this is un-American. Dissent is un-American, and I don't care if it appears in the most apparently insignificant of places. We're going to condemn it, and people are basically going to pay for it. And I think that sets such a chilling tone across the country that all of a sudden people begin to believe that patriotism, they either believe that patriotism has no room for self-reflection or critique, or they're terrified that in the years to come, moments to come, all of a sudden the increasing militarization of the United States, this law and order regime that he celebrates, will now basically bear down, to say the very least, on people in ways that in which will suggest there'll be real consequences for dissenting. Look, people are crossing the border from Canada to the United States all the time, American citizens who, and I don't know if you see this in the American press, but their phones are being taken. I mean, they're being asked political questions like, how do you feel about Trump? I mean, they're being interrogated. These are Gestapo methods. And I think if you have to connect all the dots, you know, the attack on public education, the attack on the mayor of Puerto Rico, the attack on these football players who were kneeling, these are all part of a larger issue. You can't isolate these issues. I mean, these issues are basically about what authoritarianism does in the face of criticism. It punishes. It puts out an ideology that says any mode of dissent has a consequence, and that consequence may be very dangerous for you.
Let's talk about connecting those dots for a moment, because you write single-issue movements often reach a point where they exhaust their potential for change. There seems to me to be an unwillingness, and probably a lot of other people, among the U.S. public to look at the problems of the overall system, to hold the system accountable and responsible for the problems that is created within our culture and society. How much does that unwillingness to critique that larger system, how much does that lead to movements that are single issue rather than systemic? Are we trained to not have a systemic critique, and therefore all we have is single issues living in isolation from one another?
I think it's one of the most dreadful aspects of American politics, and it so limits people's political horizons that it actually reproduces in some way many of the problems that it thinks it's addressing. I mean, I think that we don't have a sense of comprehensive politics in the United States, meaning that we don't know how to connect the dots. We don't know how to understand that if you're going to talk about public education, you need to talk about neoliberalism. You need to talk about inequality. You need to talk about the fact that you need to talk about the rise of mass incarceration. You need to talk about creeping militarism. I mean, I think that the inability to do that does a number of things. One, it often results in movements that are fragmented, particularly on the left. You know, these movements are fragmented. They're relatively powerless in terms of the scope and the reach of their ability to speak to people. And they don't really know how to understand not just simply the strengths of these movements, but their limits in terms of producing larger and more powerful social formations, like, for instance, a third party based on democratic socialist principles. Secondly, it seems to me that intellectually, there's a kind of crippling effect that goes on when you only can focus on single issues and not understand the wider implications of what that might mean in terms of the overall political system of which you find yourself. When you have a system based on massive inequality, when you have a system that hates women, when you have a system fueled by hate, you have to ask yourself, you know, what institutions overall are being affected by this? You know, how do they connect? You know, how does the attack on schools in some way give us some sort of sense of what it means to basically increase the budget for the military or reduce taxes for the rich? You know, how do we talk about, you know, what happened in Ferguson to the long legacy and rise of the mass incarceration state in the United States, reaching from Nixon right up to Clinton to Obama? So it seems to me that single issue movements and being trapped there politically is really bad news, because it fragments and it hampers the ability of people to develop larger social political formations. Intellectually, it cripples because people don't know how to think relationally. They don't know how to think historically. You know, you can't, if you're going to talk about single issues, at the very least, you need some sort of historical understanding of how those issues evolve and how they connect to other issues, so that you can create a mode of critique that doesn't just indict and look for reformist measures to correct them, but is capable of indicting a system that actually produces them. That's the difference between reformism and radicalism. Radicalism goes to the roots. It makes connections. Reformism points to single issues and says, well, we can just solve, we'll let people out of prison at a much greater rate. You know, we won't imprison people who commit misdemeanor crimes. Well, I'm sorry, that doesn't really say anything about the nature of the incarceration state and its increasing criminalization of social problems as it destroys the social state.
Just a couple more questions for you, Henry. You write, in this instance, the masses are viewed as corrupt, incapable of assuming any viable social responsibility, and hence are considered a dispensable liability to be controlled by the financial and corporate elite, who are more enlightened than the rest of us. How much can disparaging of Trump supporters by those who oppose Trump, how much can that feed into any growing authoritarianism? Can thinking anyone who voted for Trump is an idiot also create an environment for authoritarianism?
Chuck, I think it's such a terrible position. I mean, that's about the politics of shaming. That's not about exploring what the complicated nature of the reasons that some people voted for Trump in the first place. I want to know why people voted for Trump, because I want to engage in a dialogue. Some of those people were simply against an economic system that they felt, they weren't all racist. They were against an economic system they felt was oppressive, and they were, in my estimation, they're right. But they couldn't go far enough. They couldn't really understand that Trump represented somebody that, in a sense, would just make that situation worse. If we can't engage, if we're going to shame people, rather than engage in dialogue with them, it seems to me that we commit an enormous flaw, and that is we tend to buy the assumption that education has nothing to do with politics, that there's a kind of guarantee there. Some of us are politically pure and some of us aren't. That's just bad politics, and it's a bad politics for the left, and it's a bad politics for progressives.
Henry, one last question for you, and as always, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience is going to hate your response. We have been speaking with Henry A. Giroux. He is author of The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Henry is our correspondent on all things authoritarian, and you can find out more about Henry at henryagiroux.com. That's G-I-R-O-U-X. So Trump, you write that Trump is only symptomatic of the problem and condemning him exclusively does nothing to contain it. What's the likelihood that there would be any challenge to what you call the criminogenic culture of finance, racism, and war if Hillary had won? When it comes to challenging that system, is it better that Trump won?
No, not at all, because in the most immediate sense, you know, you might find yourself in a nuclear war. Millions of people are being thrown under the bus. 800,000 young people may be exported from the country. In the most immediate sense, the nature of the suffering would have been it clearly is much worse. I think that's nonsense. At the same time, it seems to me it's a bad question. You know, I think the real issue is, do you want to vote for authoritarianism or not? And the other side of this is that this is not a vote for Hillary. It's a vote against authoritarianism in its most immediate sense, and the implications that it has for the damage and the crimes and the suffering that it would impose. All we have to do is look at the last few months of this guy's regime. I mean, he's like a roller coaster. I mean, destroying everything in his path that has anything to do with democracy, justice, dignity, and what we might call the quality of human life. The other side of this is that, and this may be the other side of the question, I'm not sure, but the other side of this is that the contradictions are now so overt, it becomes increasingly more difficult to defend this guy. I mean, you've seen the polls. I mean, what is it, 57% of the people now believe he's unfit to rule. And I think the real issue here is there's an opening. It seems to me. And that opening is the left, progressives, and people who believe in democracy have really got to begin a campaign based on the education of what it means that whether you want to live in a democracy or not, and what is the nature of the threat that we face. And people can be educated, people can be mobilized, the left can stop being so fragmented, and they need a new language for politics. They need to reinvent language in a way in which politics becomes more comprehensive. Let's talk about what it means to live in a substantive real democracy and how that democracy is being eroded through racism, being eroded through demonization, anti-immigration policies, and how those things in the long run can benefit all of us and not just some of us. If we can do that, this guy can be beaten, and maybe we'll have a third party, and maybe there'll be a future for democracy in the United States.
Well, Henry, I apologize for the lousy question from hell I just asked you, but it's always great to talk to you, sir. It's always great to get your insight. And I only have about 137 more questions for you, so maybe...
I will be on any time you want me to be, so just save them.
All right, I will. It's great to hear your smile, too. Great to talk to you, Henry. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Live from the rotting corpse that is broadcast radio, this is Hell. It's time to go to the update booth with Alex to find out how much luck he's having in getting Dave Buchan on the phone. Dave Buchan is our man in San Juan, and depending on the current state of Puerto Rico's infrastructure, Dave has been our correspondent in Puerto Rico since the last century, and we hope to be checking in with him shortly. Alex, have we had any luck?
Yeah, he's wandering around San Juan trying to get reception. I will get him on right now.
Get the That Was Hell email newsletter free every Monday. Go to thisishell.com and sign up now. This is Hell in your inbox every Monday morning. Sign up for the That Was Hell email newsletter and start every week listening to This Is Hell. Let's see, what else do I want to mention to you before we get to Dave? Oh, I got a couple of things. The best way for you to get the word out about This Is Hell is to share the entire show or individual interviews or correspondence reports. This Is Hell has a very limited promotional budget, so we want to thank all of our listeners who share the show online. Thanks this week goes out to Julie, Tom, Rich, Jay, Anarchimedia, Ola, Edmar, Jesse, Johnny, Francesco, Doug, Gorilla Gramophonics, and everyone who shared This Is Hell this week. Thanks to all of you for sharing This Is Hell, however you share the show, whether it's through Twitter or Facebook or SoundCloud or whatever. If you want to hear your name read on air and simultaneously spread the good word about the evil content of This Is Hell, all you have to do is share This Is Hell. Waiting to see if we're going to get Dave on the line. Let's go into listener feedback and see what's in there. Our first email and listener feedback this week to chuck@thisishell.com comes from longtime listener Rich. Rich writes, "Do I have this right? Apparently, another country has had the testicles to interfere with our election, the very centerpiece of our glorious democracy. The nerve! It isn't just any country. It's those hated Russians. But in spite of all that coverage in the mainstream media, you wouldn't know that interfering in foreign elections is one of the things the U.S. of A. does best. According to Dov Levin of the Carnegie Mellon University, between 1946 and the year 2000, the United States had attempted to influence presidential elections in other countries at least 81 times. Rich writes, "I think we could safely say that interfering in foreign elections is as American as apple pie. Of course, the Russians are no slouches in this department. According to Levin, Russia has interfered in foreign elections 46 times during the same period. So once again, I guess that makes us number one. USA, USA, USA." Rich includes a link to the December 2016 article, "The U.S. is no stranger to interfering in the elections of other countries," which was posted in the LA Times. So thanks, Rich. We also got an email in response to my call for artists to be featured at next summer's This Is Hell Art Show, which is something we will be doing every year during our annual anniversary party in July. Ron writes, "Hi, Chuck and Alex. I hope all is well. It's been a long, busy summer for me, but I still manage to listen to every episode of This Is Hell. I keep telling friends about the show. Most people don't take me very seriously, or they take themselves too seriously, but some do bite. So I've had some success as a pitchman. I heard your shout out for artists, so I thought I'd reach out. I'm still working on the We Kill Everything project series, and I've actually had a couple of exhibits. I've attached a couple of images of the installations, and we'll be posting these on social media shortly after today's show. I live in Denver, and I know that there is no budget on your end. Anyway, I'd refuse to have you pay even for shipping. I'd totally be willing to send work if you're interested. All of my work is portable and valueless. That's the way I like my art. Also, I'm not sure if it was the result of being mentioned on your show, but a Norwegian website posted a fantastic review of the We Kill Everything photos. The reviewer was Travis Deal. It's a really insightful and well-written essay. I suspect that he may have heard about the work when you mentioned it on your program. Here's a link to the review. It really is brilliant. We Kill Everything, signed Ron." So if you or any artist you know you think would be good for our next art show, all you have to do is email me at chuck@thisishell.com. chuck@thisishell.com. We've got good news, folks. Dave Buchan has been living in Puerto Rico since the previous century. There, he homeschools his two kids and makes theater with Theater Ublek and El Teatro Barbaro and plays music with La Banda Municipal de Macula Barun. And he also just suffered through both Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria. Dave, what's your personal situation like? Do you have water, food, electricity? What's going on down in Puerto Rico?
I took a shower last night, Chuck.
Wow. And you don't even do that in Chicago when you have regular access to water.
Well, so I'm on pace for once a week. We're good. I don't have any electricity. Are you crazy? If I get electricity in a month, it'll be a miracle. I'll be really excited. After Irma, this is the third national blackout we've had in a year. After Irma, it took 8 days for us to get electricity because Irma knocked down lots of tree branches. This time, the destruction is way incomparable. There's street, there's like the poles are down. There's transformers hanging out in the sidewalk. Like everywhere I've been, you'll get to a stretch where there's like three blocks and every single pole is down. So it's gonna be a long time before there's electricity.
Well, at the front page,
a friend has electricity.
A front page
hospital.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So there's, you know, there's supposedly like 10% of the island has electricity right now.
Is there a disparity between the wealthy areas and the impoverished areas when it comes to repairs and aid being brought in? Are the more rich areas, are they the areas that are getting electricity and water first?
You know, one thing that is sort of apparent is right now we're in the stage where everyone's kind of in the same boat. I mean, clearly people with money can afford, you know, to, you know, it's easier. But it's not, at this point, it's all dark. Like from my roof, I can look out into the night, and the only lights that I really see, there's some buildings that have generators. And so you either have like a little tiny generator in your backyard and you have a house with lights, or your building has a generator and 4 hours a day you get electricity. But like standing on my roof at night, the vast majority of lights that I see are simply security lights or lights on the outside of buildings, but they're not lights in anyone's windows. So in general, people don't. The disparity has yet to really show itself, but that's going to start happening over the course of the months that this is going to take to get through.
So let's talk about security for a second. Do you feel any less secure? Are you any more concerned for your children's safety at this point in time, or is there not an issue of looting or increased violence because of the weather?
As far as I know, there's been, like, in my neighborhood, there's been minor looting. The gas station got the cigarettes stolen. I went down to the pharmacy today, and they were telling me that someone broke in and stole cigarettes and perfume. but there's not, in general, like, I saw two guys arguing yesterday, like, two guys who worked at a supermarket yelling at each other. And that is the only real, like, tension that I've seen flare. In general, people are like, you walk down the street and you say, "How you doing?" And everyone says, "Solo bien." And solo bien is the same. It means I don't have any electricity, but I have a house and my family is safe and I have access to water. And so everyone's like, "Yeah, I'm fine. We're screwed, but we're fine. Like, we're all in the same, you know." So, and in general, like, I spent 7 hours in line the other day to put gas in the Bay's car, and I got to know my neighbors in the cars, and some, you know, people had push carts with ice cream, so I treated myself to a cold ice cream in the middle of it. But then when I got to the very front of the line, it stopped suddenly, which is my fear. It's like, I've been in this line for 6 hours and they're not going to have any gasoline. And there's army people with rifles because the gas stations are all being protected. And then I finally get in, and the guy next to me says, "See those guys over there?" And there's these two guys in handcuffs surrounded by police. And it's like, they try to cut in line and then they flashed a gun. And so that's the extent of it. I hear. Like the other night, the kids haven't been sleeping on the roof because it's much cooler. They went to sleep, and I had my 15 minutes of internet, and so I looked on Facebook, and people were freaking out. People were like, "Oh my gosh, Mad Max! Oh my gosh, the apocalypse!" And I think that there are areas that are like that, but I think in general, everyone is behaving like, "Hey, we're all in this together." So I'm not worried, other than you have to be worried, you know.
Right. And how much more militarized does it seem to be in the wake of Irma and Maria?
Not very much. They've sent troops here. The only troops I've seen are at the gas station. And then, in fact, it's almost surprising how little there is. We had a drive to my family, like my mother-in-law and aunt and the great-grandmother are all staying in a house that had no water. So we had to take some water out to them, which took a 20-minute drive. And on the way, we saw maybe two military trucks with like supplies. But that was it. Whereas you would think there should be lots of them out there. You know, like, you know, now is the time to like get stuff out there. Old San Juan didn't have, I think they have running water now, but they didn't have trucks come in with drinking water to supply to people. And so, yeah. But like one big issue is gasoline and diesel. Like there are 6,000 containers waiting at the port that they can't move because they don't have diesel to transport them, and they don't have communication to say where they should go. 80%, like there in Puerto Rico has 78 different cities, municipios, which are huge, like just giant areas. And of those, 28 have no communication, like have no way to communicate with the rest of the island. Some of those are still underwater. There's areas near me, like if I walk from my house down to the ocean, there are giant puddles of black stagnant water because there's no way to, no place for the water to go. And there's coastal communities got hit really bad in the north, and then the mountains in the south because it traversed the whole island. So
the front page of the New York Times today, the headline is "Slow Pace of Aid Riles Puerto Rico." How upset is Puerto Rico? How upset are the people that you've talked to about this, according to the New York Times, slow pace of aid and its seemingly slow response by the Trump administration to Hurricane Maria?
I mean, it's definitely a slow response. But I, you know, I ran to a friend the other day. You know, something I kind of knew, and invited her over to charge her phone because I have a solar charger. And she was saying how these two friends of ours who are touring Europe doing puppet shows, she felt really sorry that they couldn't be here. She's like, they're missing out. And it's a national trauma. I mean, you can't deny that it is a traumatic situation. And for some people, it is the trauma that you've lost your house, the trauma of you have your community is covered in mud and destroyed. And for like people like me, like I have, you know, my house is fine. I have water now. And it's, I could even say that it's just an inconvenience, but it's being experienced. It's an island-wide thing. And it is just a collective Puerto Rican experience of trauma that is requiring people to work together independent of the Trump administration. I mean, on the one hand, yes, they should send stuff. On the other hand, people are going out and clearing the streets. You know, there's a tree down in front of, you know, next door to my house, completely in the middle of the street. And so a bunch of neighbors went out and we chopped it down as much as we could. That was like 3 days afterwards. You know, like the first day after the hurricane, this guy shows up in a Superman t-shirt with a chainsaw, a machete, and an axe, and he just starts going at the tree alone. And he makes it so you can walk underneath it, so there's like a pathway. And then the next night, this kid, like 20 years old, shows up with a machete and a headlamp. And the night is just hit. There's a curfew. You can't be up from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. And he shows up a little after 7, and he says, "Do you have a light?" And what's going on? He says, "I'm going to take down that tree." And I was like, "Well, good luck," because I mean, huge tree. And so he stands there for like a half an hour with this machete, just hacking at it. And it's clearly like, I need to hack something. I just need to beat this frustration out of me. And then he went home. But then the next day, like a bunch of us went out, and it's much more cleared off. But that's happening everywhere. You know, there are, you know, people are working together in the neighborhoods. Yeah, another thing here is that I can call you, but I can't call anyone in San Juan. Like I have, because of the communication, the communicating with each other is really difficult. Transportation, of course, is really difficult because once you have gas in your car, you use it sparingly, so you don't have to wait another 7 hours. But clearly, and I can't really say what's going on with the Trump administration because I don't read the news.
Right.
So one thing I can say about the news, like I talked to my dad, and then I talked to my parents early, and he watches the news, and he just calls me like, you know, you're living in the apocalypse. What is happening? Oh, my God. There are people who are in a bad situation. There are a lot of people who are not. In San Juan, there's food. You know, you may have to stand in line. But, like, under the circumstances, people are doing okay. Granted, the circumstances are, you know, you're not going to have electricity for a couple months, and your selection of food options are limited, and you have to filter your water because the water treatment plants failed, and so who knows what's in your water. But to me, it's the apocalypse, but people are doing well in the apocalypse. I went down to the pizza place that's got a generator, and I had the best cold beer of my life. Even though there's ley seca, legally you can't sell alcohol because it's an emergency. And the only other time that they have ley seca is on election days. You cannot sell alcohol. The joke being that if Puerto Ricans got drunk, they'd vote for independence. So I suppose they're worried now that if we all got drunk, we'd you know, declare an independent state and take care of it ourselves.
Yeah, I saw this report on CNN. I can see why your dad thinks that, because CNN is just, they're only focusing on the, you know, the most horrific stuff that they can show, because that's what grabs eyeballs. So what are, one of the reports I saw, they were saying that there's no water, there's no food, there's no electricity. They were just using that as a statement for the entire island, for everybody on the entire island. So what are you doing for food other than going to the pizza place at your corner?
Luckily, I really like a peanut butter sandwich with bananas and rice. Like, that to me is tasty. I'm lucky in that regard. And I have a little stove now, so I'm going to start cooking on my stove. But there's a grocery store open near me. It's fascinating. A lot of it, you know, some of the changes in your life are like, as it turns twilight, you make sure, okay, I have water, and I know where my lanterns are, and the kids are you know, ready. And so a lot of your life is much more structured in that way. It's just like, this time of day is approaching. There's also lots more walking. I don't have any closed shoes, and I have all these cuts because there's glass everywhere. So I had to go walk a mile and a half for some shoes yesterday. And so there's stuff out there. You just have to get there. And along the way you run into people and you say, how are you, you all right? And they all say, Dolbien, you know? And so granted, I'm not in Cataño, which is like across the bay from San Juan, which is still flooded, and situations there. I mean, there's people, in shelters still. There's people who've lost their homes. So on the one hand, those images you've seen are true, but they're not everywhere. And so it's a combination of, there are people who have a difficult access to food, here in San Juan, the vast majority of the people are doing okay.
So, President...
Okay, asterisk.
President Trump said that we have never seen anything like Hurricane Maria before when it comes to the devastation wrought by Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Irma, and that the electrical grid in Puerto Rico has been severely damaged. But he added that, quote, the electrical grid wasn't that great to begin with. How bad was electricity distribution in Puerto Rico prior to Maria? Because the way that President Trump has kind of packaged or explained Puerto Rico to people is that it's very much like a developing economy.
You know, a friend always said that Puerto Rico is a third world country that likes to pretend it was a first world country. And so, yeah, I mean, the electoral system is bad here. It hasn't been maintained because the country is in debt. It's a poor country. But, you know, poor countries are poor for a reason. There are rich countries who make money off of them. Just like the water system. The water system here has been bad for years. I mean, when I first moved to Puerto Rico, I was like, I can't wait for a hurricane because I like storms. I'm from Chicago. I like the big thunderstorms. I'm really excited. Can't wait to see a hurricane. And everyone is like, you're insane, because the problem is not the hurricane. The problem is afterwards when you have no water and lights. And I was like, oh, okay. But then over the years, this is my first hurricane since getting here in 99, first two. But over those 19 years, I've experienced not having water and not having lights because the system is bad. But, you know, it's true, but it's true for a reason. It's because it's a colony, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that just for a second. So how much does bankruptcy exacerbate the problems that Puerto Rico may be facing, could face with reconstruction?
It's going to be... you know, to get through this is going to take investment, and it's going to take money, and it's going to take, you know, tons. And the junta is not going to help at all. And having to come out of it and then them say, all right, now you can pay the debt that we've got tallied up to you, is this a huge drag on the possibilities of the future. Though it's interesting in the paper, the newspapers now, very exciting. Newspapers of the day, representatives from all three parties are calling for the junta to be either put on hold for 5 years or disbanded entirely, but like across the spectrum. So I think that the sense of it is a collective Puerto Rican trauma. It is something that we're all going through and is working every day to, you know, survive, combined with the realities of what it's going to take to rebuild the country. The resistance against the junta is going to be much more widespread. Whereas before there was really only token resistance from the parties, I think that that's going to start changing.
They've also said that they closed the banks and that Puerto Ricans are running out of money. On the front page of the New York Times today, there's a line of people at a bank getting money. So apparently they haven't closed all the banks. But what will happen if Puerto Ricans run out of cash?
I don't know what happened to that. I waited in line the other day at an ATM to get cash, and I noticed that bank is no longer open. But yesterday, when I was walking around, I saw another bank with a long line. It's interesting. It's the cash economy again. Like when I bought my gasoline, I paid the $30 maximum you could put into your car. And inside the booth, there was two people, one to take my money and one woman who was just standing there feeding $20 bills into a machine that was counting them all. It's just like stacks and stacks of cash. I hope we don't run out of money.
Well, I'm hoping for you. I hope that everything goes well for you, Dave. I'm going to be trying to get you back on the show in the real near future so you can give us an update on what's happening with you. It's great to hear that you and your loved ones are doing well and that it's not the apocalypse. It's the apocalypse asterisk. I really appreciate that.
And then one thing I just want to say about disasters is they happen. And then the hurricane's over. But the real disaster is a long, slow process. And so lots of people right now, thankfully, are saying, how can I help? And are making donations and are sending money to people who are doing good work. But the truth is that in 2 months from now, in 4 months from now, there's still going to need the help. So just to remember that it's not going away. Like, it's going to disappear from the New York Times and disappear from CNN, but it is going to be a long, slow process of rebuilding. And you know, there's, like, hopefully rebuilding in a way that is not, you know, the terms of capitalism. Radiovieques.net, you can go there and donate to them. Like, Vieques in particular is going to be faced with the dilemma of, like, okay, now that we're rebuilding, are we going to be rebuilding for the rich tourists and the people who have their houses there, or for the population that lives there? So that's going to be a hard issue as well.
All right, Dave, we're going to have to leave it there because we're up against the clock. There's sports is coming up, so
time for some football.
Yes. All right. Take care, Dave.
Hello to everyone in Chicago.
All right. Love you, brother.
Love you. Bye.
Bringing you bong-hitting journalism since 1996, This Is Hell. You can now become a supporter of This Is Hell via Patreon. If you become a regular Patreon supporter, and you will not only will we show you our appreciation by sending you some This Is Hell subvertising stickers, but you'll also have access to special perks, including every week getting a classic interview from our back catalog of 20-plus years of on-air conversations selected by me. This week's Patreon podcast is going to be one that we did back in 2005 with Robin Hanel, who had just published his book, Economics, Justice, and Democracy. We've been talking about, during our Patreon podcast, doing this talk of alternative economics, an alternative the likes of Reagan, Thatcher, even Clinton insisted did not exist, and their friends in big media still ignore. So we're talking about alternative economics during the Patreon podcast. Again, this week we're featuring the interview, 2005 interview with Robin Hanel, one of the co-creators, along with Michael Albert, of participatory economics. But you only can get that if you are a Patreon patron of This Is Hell. Thanks again to all our Patreon patrons for supporting This Is Hell. Special thanks to your creative placement of This Is Hell subvertising stickers. You can see them all now at Instagram at This Is Hell Radio. On next week's show, it's the guy who predicted Trump's presidency back before Obama beat Mitt Romney in 2012, Corey Robin, who has a new edition of his book, The Reactionary Mind. I'll see you at office hours every Wednesday from 6 to 9 p.m. at Carrie's Lounge, 2251 West Devon. There's only one way to get over all of the problems that we introduced to you on our show today. That's by sitting down in the lotus position, turning your palms towards the sky, focusing on that burning white dot in the middle of your forehead, and saying the simple words, everybody's stupid.
My demon is on my butt.
Matt Damon.
My demon talks to me in profanity like a sailor. And my demon tries to knock me down. And my demon tries to put me on a hell ride.